world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. You've heard the saying a bunch of times, high risk, high reward. It's often used as a rough guide to investing for those of us who don't really know what we're doing. But risk is so subjective that it turns out you might be better off ignoring it. And yesterday, cocoa prices reached an all-time high. This is partly because West Africa's farmers had a much less bountiful harvest season, and that has ripple effects for chocolate lovers everywhere. But first, there are more than 2 million people in Gaza, and they're running out of food. According to the charity Save the Children, many people are eating leaves and foraging for scraps on the streets. The IPC, a UN measure for classifying malnutrition, reports that 30% of Gaza's population is experiencing catastrophic food insecurity, and that there could be grounds to declare a famine in parts of Gaza as early as May. The last time that happened was in South Sudan 7 years ago. Avoiding famine depends on a ceasefire and faster supplies of aid. The UN reckons that less than 5% of food trucks entering the strip reached the north in the month to March 18th. But there's another way for aid to get through. Countries including the United States, Jordan, Egypt, and Britain are dropping food from the sky. It bypasses the inspections and delays at land border crossings. But the volume of aid is much, much lower than it would be on the ground. And it's a lot more expensive, too.
The first thing you see when you get to the airbase is that it is very clearly a multinational affair.
Our producer, Peter Granitz, was on one of those drops this week.
There are planes on the flight line from a whole coalition of countries. There were planes from Jordan, the United Kingdom. This was the first day that the United Kingdom was actually doing their aid delivery. Singapore, Germany, the United Arab Emirates, and the one that I got to go along on, which was an American plane. There is a lot of activity on the ground. There are teams from all these air forces assembling pallets of food and water in airplane hangars. The foodstuffs are staples, things like rice, flour, canned vegetables, and meat. And all of those are getting cinched down onto wood pallets with netting and with tarps. And on the top of them, people are affixing parachutes with ratchet straps. And then somebody comes and forklifts them onto the planes a few hours before they take off.
Peter, what's the flight like?
Well, for one, it is very loud.
The plane is finally pulled forward. We're now on the runway with the last of the convoy of flights that's flying aid into Gaza today. In about 45 minutes' time, we'll be over Gazan airspace.
We took off from an airbase outside of Amman, and the planes take off one after the other. There were six on the day that I went. The planes travel at a pretty low altitude because the flight from Jordan to Gaza is not very far. They also need to be low to the ground to be as precise as possible to drop the aid. We went due west over Amman. At one point, we crossed the Jordan River, and if you looked out of the south side of the plain, you could see the Dead Sea, which meant we were crossing into Israeli airspace. You fly over Jericho and then over Jerusalem, but it was too cloudy to see Jerusalem. But the U.S. Air Force let me into the cockpit as we were heading west towards Jerusalem, and it got clear out, and you could see the skyscrapers of Tel Aviv and the blue Mediterranean Sea and the sandy beaches. But then at some point, we took a sharp bank south over the Mediterranean Sea, and you start to see Gaza, and it looks a lot different than Israel. You can see the barrier between the Gaza Strip and Israel. And on the Gaza Strip side, the buildings are much more densely packed. At least one of them was smoking, and we were getting lower and lower all the while. I was watching the altitude gauge in the plane, and it ticked down pretty quickly. We went from 17,000 feet down to 2,000 before the back doors opened.
And what about the drop itself?
Well, about 10 minutes before the drop, the team opens the back doors of the plane. And you can probably imagine a cargo plane, right? There are two doors below the tail. One of them folds down and the other up. These are giant doors. These are things that vehicles can drive up. And it gets even louder when the doors open. Everything is latched down into place, but things are still flapping around. It's cold. And I have to say that, you know, when a door opens on a plane, it's quite something. There's only a piece of plywood standing between you and the cargo and a giant open door several thousand feet in the sky. So it's something to take in. And then the loadmaster yells to the team to get ready.
1 minute!
And then two airmen actually use a knife to just cut the strap that is holding the pallets in the plane. Or on this flight, there were 16 pallets of food, and they were gone in a moment. For all of the hours of preparation and loading and packing and logistics, everything was out the door in a few seconds. The parachutes deploy immediately, and then once the load is dropped, the plane banks further out over the sea. The crew starts packing up, reattaching the cables and securing everything back in place, and they go on. It's so quick, you don't see where things are going. I asked the crew after if it was landing on the beach or landing on the land. And they said they release it over the sea and the wind and the parachutes would guide it towards the beach.
How much of an impact can these flights have?
Unfortunately, not much. The plane that I was on had 6,400 pounds of food donated by Jordan. It was an American flight, but the aid came from Jordan. There were six planes in total, and they take off every other day from this airbase. But the scale of hunger is just so severe that airdrops are completely insufficient. I spoke with Adele Khador. She's the Middle East Regional Director for UNICEF. She says that trucks are the most efficient and the most effective way to bring the volume of necessary supplies into Gaza.
The airdrops are not really enough. So we really think that there should be additional entry routes that should be opened into Gaza. We need to allow more trucks to go in, a larger number of trucks. We need to speed up the inspections at the points of entry. And we need to have enough trucks within Gaza itself to be able to transport some of these supplies into the remote corners and into some areas where the airdrops will not work.
And Aura, every day this week, there have been fewer than 180 trucks entering Gaza. And the weekly averages before that were just about 160 per day. So there is definitely not enough supplies getting into the people who need it.
Well, how long will the airdrops continue to supplement the slowed down aid trucks?
Everyone involved says the most important need is a ceasefire to allow for aid to get in. Now, on Monday, the UN Security Council approved a resolution for a ceasefire for the remaining 2 weeks of Ramadan. But the people with the U.S. Air Force told me they will continue with the missions. There is no end date yet. But it's unclear how big the stockpiles of aid are, and the drops are not guaranteed to go every day or every other day that they're supposed to. This was actually the second one that I tried to get on. I went the previous week, and the plane was fully loaded with the aid, and it got called off at the last minute, and people at the base said it was likely because of ground fighting. Jeremy Anderson is the U.S. mission commander for the drops, and he says some elements are just out of his control.
I always say there's man, weather, and machine, and all three have to cooperate. We just have to be flexible and be ready to adhere to whatever the mission might throw at us. So if it does cancel, then we'll roll with the punches and we'll be ready to go tomorrow or the day after or whenever the call comes to do the next mission.
But Ori, that is not a sustainable solution. That is not going to alleviate a hunger crisis for 2.2 million people.
Peter, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
When it comes to investing, it's sometimes said that high risk can bring high reward. But does taking on riskier investments actually produce better returns? According to modern portfolio theory, originated by American economist Harry Markowitz in 1952, and for which he later won the Nobel Prize in Economics, investors should maximize returns according to their appetite for risk. So, only investing in the riskiest stocks if they offer a better shot at making them rich. But what does riskiness actually mean? And how can investors judge it when deciding where to put their money?
Deciding what your risk appetite is sounds simple, but it's not really, because risk is quite a slippery and difficult concept to define.
Joshua Roberts is the Economist's finance correspondent.
You might mean the chance of you facing a loss. You might mean the spread of outcomes you'll get from your investments. You might mean not meeting a goal like being able to pay for your kids' university fees or retiring when you want to. But actually translating that into something that you can put into an investment portfolio is really difficult. Because risk is so difficult to define, a lot of investors and a lot of wealth managers use volatility instead.
What's the difference between the two?
So risk is this kind of slippery subjective concept, but volatility means something definite. It's about the spread of outcomes that you might get from a particular investment. So we assume that investment returns follow something like a bell curve, and volatility describes how wide that bell curve is. So a high volatility stock makes it more likely that you'll get an extreme result, a big gain or a big loss. And volatility is a really important concept for the theoretical framework a lot of investors use to pick their stocks. This is called modern portfolio theory. And one of the key tenets of it is that the more risk you're willing to take, the more returns you can get from your portfolio.
You kind of make it sound easy. Decide how much risk you can take, the more of a daredevil you are and the higher your returns are going to be. But I'm guessing you're about to tell me it's not that simple.
Yeah, so this concept that taking more risk is likely to give you a greater expected return sounds very intuitive. It makes sense to people. That's why it's quite widely used. But when you look at the long-run data of how stocks actually perform, it turns out that it's not true. So the gurus of long-run investment returns are three academics. They're called Elroy Dimson, Paul Marsh, and Mike Staunton. And every year they release what they call the Global Investment Returns Yearbook. And it looks at long-run performance for stock and bonds. And it's a really good way of testing theoretical ideas like this risk-return trade-off against how stock markets actually perform. And this year, they studied US share prices since 1963 and British share prices since 1984. And they ordered them according to their volatility. And then they looked at how stocks of different volatilities actually performed. And the results actually turned out not to validate this idea of risk and return at all. The highest volatility stocks, which you might have expected to be the highest yielding stocks, actually turned out to be the worst performing stocks, not the best. And among the remainder, volatility had basically no impact on stocks' actual performance.
And why is that?
It's kind of difficult to explain because we're just looking at how stocks actually did. There's nothing in the data that tells you exactly why they performed the way they did. You can get an idea, though, from looking at the types of stocks that were very volatile. So overall, the highest volatility stocks tended to be from much smaller companies than the lower volatility stocks. And small companies are more risky, right? They tend to have lower cash buffers. They tend to be more vulnerable to competition. They tend to be more vulnerable to economic headwinds like recessions. So that kind of explains why those stocks are higher risk and therefore more volatile. But it also gives you a bit of a picture as to why they performed badly, right? Because when recessions did hit, these stocks were wiped out, whereas the bigger ones managed to weather the storm.
Well, if these stocks don't offer a higher return, then why do people keep taking the risk with them?
It might be that people don't hate risk as much as investment theory and wealth managers think they do. They're happy taking it without a higher expected return. I think probably the more likely explanation is people simply don't realize that the most volatile stocks don't lead to greater expected returns. They think those are going to be higher yielding and they turn out not to be. But either way, they are definitely taking return-free risk.
Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Chocoholic, you may have noticed that your habit has become dearer of late.
Cocoa beans are a hot commodity right now. In fact, they've never been more expensive.
The price of cocoa began creeping up in the second half of 2022, and since then, it has more than tripled. Yesterday, it surged above $10,000 per tonne for the first time ever. This spells trouble for the chocolate business and its rather sweet-toothed customers.
A lot of chocolate companies, such as Hershey's and Mondelez International, who is the owner of Cadbury, passed on the cost to shoppers last year. And as a chocolate lover myself, this is a big issue.
Carla Subirana is a digital journalist at The Economist.
Hershey's year-on-year profit fell by 11.5% during the fourth quarter, and the company announced that it would cut 5% of its workforce. And also Barry Callebaut, who you may not have heard about, but it's the world's biggest chocolate maker, said that they would lay off 2,500 people, or 18% of their workforce.
Oh, wow. Okay, this is not sounding good. Although, to be honest, I never particularly liked Hershey's anyway. But Carla, tell me, why is this happening?
Ore, it doesn't matter to me. I'll eat any brand, Hershey's or whatever it is. But in any case, in part, the price spikes are because of extreme climate events in cocoa growing regions. Cocoa is mostly grown by small farmers in West Africa. Around 60% of the world's crop is produced in Ghana and Ivory Coast alone. And last season, El Niño, a weather pattern, caused unseasonably high rain in these countries, which damaged crops. Total rainfall in Ivory Coast cocoa growing regions was the highest in 20 years last year, according to Grow Intelligence, a data company. And as a result of this, production was much lower than in previous years. And this year, there has been no respite. El Niño is causing a severe drought in West Africa, so production has fallen even more. And currently, supplies are at their lowest level in years. ING, the bank, estimates that this year the gap between global production and consumption will be the widest since at least 2014. And if you're interested in seeing a visualization of this, you can head over to the graphic details section of economist.com.
But Carla, surely it's not just chocolate that's being affected by these extreme weather patterns.
Yeah, that's true. Some listeners might remember that a while ago, I came on the show to talk to Jason about rising olive oil prices, also partly caused by extreme weather patterns. But extreme weather patterns are affecting food production all over the world. In Thailand and India, droughts are damaging rice plantations. And in Brazil, torrential rains have affected sugar exports. However, some of the reasons for the price spikes are specific to the cocoa industry. The heavy rainfall allowed two diseases that are big killers of cocoa trees to spread across Ghana and the Ivory Coast last year. These two diseases are called the swollen shoot virus and the black pod disease. And Tropical Research Services estimates that by the end of 2023, the swollen shoot virus had infected around 20% of the Ivory Coast's cocoa trees.
And you said that climate patterns are partly to blame. But if they're only partly to blame, what else is a factor in the price of chocolate going up?
Well, the cocoa industry has some structural problems that have also contributed to the supply crunch. Governments in Ghana and the Ivory Coast regulate cocoa markets heavily. So government set the prices for farmers. And this means that farmers don't benefit from price spikes. In Ghana, current wholesale prices are 250% higher than Ghana's farm gate price in 2023, according to the Corporate Accountability Lab, an NGO. Because of this, farmers are not incentivized to plant new trees or spend money on fertilizer. And as a result, no new plantations have been created in the Ivory Coast in almost 25 years. That has made the trees more vulnerable to bad weather and disease, exacerbating the supply crunch.
Carla, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Ore.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Don't forget, you can always get in touch at podcasts@economist.com. We will see you back here tomorrow.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.